We also established American leadership in the global pursuit of the clean energy of the 21st century. I'm proud that the G20 nations agreed to phase out $300 billion worth of fossil fuel subsidies. This will increase our energy security, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, combat the threat of climate change, and help create the new jobs and industries of the future.
The thing about the World Bank, and the same applies to the export credit agencies, is that if the Brown government, the Obama administration, were to decide they wanted to end these fossil fuel subsidies, these are things that they could do with the stroke of a pen.
Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, the weekly independent climate change bulletin that's made for Resonance 104.4 FM in London and syndicated to community radio and other independent media around the globe. The UN climate talks resumed in Bangkok on Monday, but this week we turn our attention to the apparent breakthrough at the G20 in Pittsburgh on the issue of phasing out fossil fuel subsidies. I was honoured to be able to speak with Steve Kretzmann earlier this week to get an overview of the issue and see what this might mean in practice. Steve worked as an environmental advisor to Ken Sarawiwa and the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People in Nigeria, before setting up Project Underground, which campaigned and shed light on the apparently systemic human rights and environmental violations of the mining and extraction industries. He's now Executive Director of Oil Change International, which he founded in 2005. Here he is, speaking to me by phone from Washington, D.C.
I mean, I know you've been working on energy issues and global oil industry for some 20 years, but you've narrowed your focus down increasingly to the issue of subsidies to the fossil fuel corporations. Why do you think subsidies are such a critical target?
Well, I think ultimately when you look at the issue of the oil industry in particular, but the fossil fuel industry in general, the problem that we have been having trying to reduce our dependency on fossil fuels across the board is the extremely tight nature that happens in between our governments and these industries. And that's why we actually run a campaign that we call Separation of Oil and State. And on one side, we track in the United States the campaign contributions that come from the oil and coal industry and go into the U.S. Congress and the presidential race, et cetera, elected officials across the board here in the U.S. And on the other side, we look at what they get back for that payment, and that's subsidies. And I think that if we actually expect to move forward on our clean energy transition that we all know we need to get serious about fighting climate change, we're going to need to separate oil and coal and state. Stopping subsidies and stopping the campaign contributions is very high on that list.
In terms of the international subsidies, can we talk about some of the main culprits there? I mean, I know the World Bank is trying to rebrand itself almost as a kind of central player in this whole new climate change landscape, if you like, and particularly trying to get a role for itself in the UN climate change deal that may or may not come out of Copenhagen. But actually, it's got a terrible record in financing fossil fuel developments, hasn't it, and subsidising fossil fuel corporations.
It does, actually. It has a really terrible record. And the truly scandalous thing is that record is getting worse, even as they're trumpeting their fitness to lead the fight against climate change globally. There has been a huge increase in lending for fossil fuels over the last 3 years, at a very dramatic increase, particularly in coal. And they talk about how they've increased lending for renewable energy, and that's true, but they've increased lending for renewable energy quite a bit less than they have increased lending for fossil fuels, thus making an already very large gap in between the two of those quite a bit larger. And so for all of this, when we talk about subsidies, we're trying to level the energy market, the playing field, you know, for clean energy to be able to compete with fossil fuels. And right now, that playing field is completely skewed towards fossil fuels. And Nicholas Stern, the former World Bank chief economist who wrote the huge report on climate change a few years back, called climate change the most significant market failure of all time and called fossil fuel subsidies the most obvious source of that failure and that market distortion. And so removing these subsidies, it really should be a no-brainer, but it's very difficult and it's very fraught with politics and power. The thing about the World Bank that it's worth noting, and the same applies to the export credit agencies, is that these agencies, you could actually, you know, if the Brown government, the Obama administration were to decide they wanted to end these fossil fuel subsidies, these are things that they could do with the stroke of a pen. And so we have the G20 now saying that they're committed to ending fossil fuel subsidies, and the Obama administration in particular leading that charge, which is great, but they're saying on one hand, well, we can't do it internationally until we get China and India and the other developing countries on board, which is a flawed concept in and of itself, but we can come back to that. And they say we can't do it domestically because we need Congress or Parliament to sign off on getting rid of those things. And in the United States, the Republicans and other oily representatives won't let them end the subsidies. But what they could do right away is end World Bank and Export Credit Agency funding for fossil fuels. So that's the first place to look to see if they're quite serious about this commitment.
Okay. What kind of figures are we talking about in terms of World Bank support for fossil fuels? And by comparison, renewable energy? I mean, I understand, isn't it the largest funder of fossil fuel projects in the world? Is that correct?
Historically, it's certainly been it's the largest multilateral funder of fossil fuel projects. And it's the largest public funder, of course, private money. Mm. You know, if you look at an Exxon, et cetera, and that's quite a bit. Yeah. But, yeah, it's the largest multilateral funder. Last year, it was on the order of something like $5.5 billion for fossil fuels. And then you compare that to the new renewables, and that is solar, wind, the kinds of things we want to see good money go towards. And, you know, it's just coming in right around $1 billion, right, at most. And that depends on how you count some of those numbers. If you put in large hydro dams, the bank gets a little bit higher, and they do tend to count that as clean energy, although that's quite controversial among a lot of environmentalists who don't believe it is. And then the bank also counts things like more energy-efficient coal plants as energy efficiency and clean energy, which is also, I think, a little bit specious.
Okay. And its funding for coal seems to have been going up in the last few years, even.
Yeah.
If you just look at coal, take that out as a separate item.
Yeah, well, last year there was a 256% increase in their funding for coal. A lot of that has to do with a very large project they funded in India, which, quite frankly, there were some great studies out that showed that you could have met that demand with centralized solar power, but they didn't, and they decided to fund old coal. I mean, at the end of the day, this is really a question of what should public money be used for. What should our tax dollars be used for? And we feel quite strongly that it should be used to encourage the energy future that we all know is coming, that even the politicians completely say we need. This is what we should be using our tax dollars to really support, rather than just propping up an old and already quite profitable industry in coal and oil.
Right. I've got a news item here from The Times, 16th of September, just a few weeks ago. On the one hand, I think that was the day that the World Bank issued a report about climate change, and in amongst its 260 pages, The Times pulled out a quote where the World Bank advises against locking the world into high carbon infrastructure, and of course makes no mention of its own plans and ongoing support for fossil fuels. And then they interview the bank's chief economist for sustainable development, who justifies this apparent anomaly. She says, there are a lot of poor countries which have coal reserves, and for them it's the only option. The bank's policy is to continue funding coal to the extent that there is no alternative, and to push for the most efficient coal plants possible. Frankly, it would be immoral at this stage to say we want to have clean hands, therefore we are not going to touch coal. So they have no intention of not funding coal. they think it's a good thing. That's quite remarkable.
Yeah, well, that's what they always say. Yeah, it is quite remarkable. You're right. They say that with a straight face, and they tend to say that they tend to make it about energy poverty and access to energy, and they say that, oh, well, if you're asking us to close off coal, then you're condemning huge swaths of people to not having access to energy, and that's so callous of you, and obviously you don't care for the poor, and blah, blah, blah. And this, nothing could be further from the truth. First of all of us are completely committed to the ideal of getting energy to as many people as we possibly can. We understand that that's very important and an important factor in development. There are many cheaper and easier ways than building centralized coal plants to do this. On top of that, and I think this is really what's most telling, is you look, for instance, this big coal plant that I just mentioned a bit ago in India that the bank funded. The majority of that power is actually for a factory for export, which is profiting a large multinational corporation, right? It's not about, and most of these projects, I did a study a few years back that looked at bank oil projects. It showed that of those places where the bank was supporting oil projects, more than 80% of them were designed for export to fuel SUVs and gasoline in Europe and the United States. It's not about energy poverty for the bank. It's about propping up big corporations and this notion that spreading Western corporations is somehow good for development, which is pretty much bankrupt when you actually look at the data. I mean, there was a study that the bank commissioned itself called the Extractive Industries Review earlier this decade. And the premise of that was, we're going to look at the bank's support for oil and coal and other things and see whether or not and how those projects have done at alleviating poverty. So this study took 3 years. It had a huge multi-stakeholder input. It was designed by a committee picked by the bank. It was headed by a man from Indonesia, Dr. Emil Salim, who also at the time was on the board of a coal company in Indonesia. And they came out with the recommendation at the end that the bank should stop funding coal and oil projects because the bank's mission is to alleviate poverty. And after 3.5 years of studying this, they couldn't come up with a single example of a place where their support for these projects had actually alleviated poverty locally. They found examples where, you know, of course, people made a lot of money and that kind of thing, but you really can't point to a model project. I mean, their biggest model project for many years was the Chad Cameron pipeline, which then completely fell apart when the local dictator ended up using the financing that was being provided to buy arms to suppress local dissent. So the bank wants to say this is about development and about poverty alleviation, and the facts just don't bear that out. And I think that, you know, every couple of years they get a new generation of people working in their PR office who dutifully go out and say this. And, you know, I just wonder, have these people actually read the studies of what's happened beforehand? And I think, sadly, the answer is not.
Okay. Well, we should give you some credit there, because I understand that you were involved in the kind of civil society effort that resulted in that review for the World Bank. Is that correct?
Yeah, thank you.
So I think the question should be, what do you think should happen? You've already said that at a stroke of a pen, the support for the World Bank, multilateral development banks and export credit agencies could be, is that correct? That could happen at a stroke of a pen. Could that be done under the United Nations climate talks? Is that the best place for it?
It wouldn't be done under the auspices of that. In the case of the World Bank, it's the Treasury Department in the United States or your finance ministry, et cetera, or the other finance around the OECD that would simply instruct their directors that sit at the World Bank to stop voting for fossil fuel projects.
Right.
That's very simple. The export credit agencies in the United States, there's two of them, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation and the U.S. Export-Import Bank. So that is simply a matter of, in the United States, the administration just instructing the head of that agency to stop supporting fossil fuel projects. And I would imagine if it's an agency that's part of the government, that it would be very, very similar
in
the UK, although I confess that I don't know the parliamentary nuances of how that might flow.
Okay, so, and interestingly, because at the G20 they've all kind of signed up to this in theory, they could actually just go ahead and show that they actually mean it and do it.
Yes, that's right. They could go ahead and say, we're going to particularly stop multilateral and export credit support for fossil fuels, not only because it's a down payment on stopping fossil fuels, but also because these funds actually subsidize the building of carbon-intensive infrastructure in the developing world. And so if we're asking the developing world to join us in fighting climate change and stopping subsidizing fossil fuels, a good thing to do would be to stop building more carbon-intensive infrastructure in their countries. Okay. And indeed, to use that public money that's there now for helping them to build clean energy, you know, helping to facilitate that. And that's something that clean energy producers, particularly in the United States, have been saying, hey, how come we're not getting as much public support to put our products into the developing world market as the fossil fuel industry still does? It's an excellent question.
And looking at the text of the Pittsburgh final document that came out of the G20, the leader's statement, what they've actually done instead is to say they're actually going to ask what they're calling relevant institutions such as the IEA, OPEC, OECD and the World Bank to provide an analysis of the scope of energy subsidies and suggestions for the implementation of this initiative and report back at the next summit. So they're asking them for advice rather than instructing them to do something, which is obvious, really.
Yeah. They also said they're to doing it, and then they said that how we'll do it, you know, we'll get back to you on that because we're doing a study, right? And that's... there's a lot of reason to be concerned about who's doing those studies. You heard both OPEC and the World Bank be mentioned as people involved in that study. That's a bit troubling. But our organization and others are going to be watchdogging that process very closely, and we certainly hope to hold the G20 leaders to their word that it's time to stop subsidizing fossil fuels.
Okay, I mean, you've been campaigning on this for many years. When did Obama start campaigning on this, and what was your reaction to that when he did?
He actually started campaigning on this in the campaign, talking about the need to end fossil fuel subsidies, and it was something that we were very happy about. You know, it's something that the idea of stopping handouts to big oil in the United States is something that polls very well across the board. You know, it has bipartisan appeal, and so it's clear that people understand that the oil industry, which makes record profits, does not need public support. And I think President Obama is simply trying to follow through on a campaign pledge, and now it's going to get quite sticky about how that actually happens. But I think it's a very clever move, because I think now, domestically in the United States, it's going to put Republicans and even those Democrats who are allied with the oil industry into a defensive posture where they're going to have to explain publicly why they think the oil industry should continue to get public money. And that's always interesting and tortured arguments to hear come out. So,
when it was first mooted that Obama might put this forward as a suggestion to the G20, you went into print saying, great, but let's hope he doesn't do it in the wrong way. What were your fears, and was that justified in terms of what actually came out in the final G20 statement?
You know, the G20 initially was supposed to issue statements and make commitments on climate finance, particularly money made available by developed countries for adaptation to climate change and the building out of clean energy in the global south, in the developing countries. And they didn't really have, at the end of the day, much to say about climate finance. But my concern upon seeing that they were particularly looking at the subsidies proposal at this time in this forum was that they were going to turn around and say, Well, look, there's plenty of money available for fighting climate change in China and India and elsewhere if only they would stop subsidizing fossil fuels. And that totally really misses the point, unfortunately, because the money that is made available in developing countries, for the most part, is actually money that actually is intended to improve the energy access, improve the ability of the poor to be able to access energy services, transport, light, heat, et cetera. That's very different than the payment to big oil and coal corporations, which tends to happen in the North. And so looking at the difference in between those two is quite tricky. And making sure that the U.S., the U.K., and other northern countries who are responsible for the largest part of greenhouse gas emissions actually end up paying to help other countries adapt and transition to a new and better economy, well, I think that's very important from an equity and justice point of view as well.
Okay. Any final words about next steps or how to move this forward now that there's a kind of foot in the door, really?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be front and center, actually, in the Copenhagen talks, although for some of the reasons I just outlined, it's going to be a somewhat difficult discussion to have there. But I think it's one of the few substantive things that the Obama administration is going to be talking about going into Copenhagen, which is in and of itself quite a tragedy. But there will be lots of opportunities to continue to pressure all of our governments to live up to the pledge and stop subsidizing fossil fuels, and we're going to take every opportunity we get and seek to create more.
That was Steve Kretzmann of Oil Change International speaking to me by phone from Washington, D.C. earlier this week. We're going to end today's program with a brief radio interview with the inspirational 81-year-old military veteran Roland Micklem, who is devoting his final years to leading senior citizens in direct action against mountaintop removal coal mining in the U.S. To get references for this week's show or to hear the program again, check out the Climate Radio Archive at www.climateradio.org. Thanks for listening.
What's been going on in Boone County, West Virginia?
Well, this has been a campaign against mountaintop removal that's been going on for quite a few years. For my own personal history, I've been here since the 23rd of June. I participated in an action on that day, and I've been here ever since. And the latest action was we were, five of us chained ourselves together to block the entrance of the Massey Coal Company, which is responsible for most of the mountaintop removal in this area. We are organizing a senior citizens' march to take place beginning October the 8th and ending the following Monday from in the area, Charleston area. We're going to walk 25 miles to the site of a mountaintop removal facility, and there we'll demonstrate. And some people may commit civil disobedience.
Roland, can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in this really important issue?
Okay, well, I've been an environmental writer for the past 30 years, and I'm not a big-time person. I've written for weekly newspapers up in my hometown of Savannah, New York. I've also written to legislators. I've attended meetings and have decided, and it seems that none of the legal, none of the conventional channels alone are going to deal with this issue. And so I decided that I'd have to step outside the box and join this campaign of nonviolent direct action, which does involve quite a bit of illegalities. And I also want to say that I don't know, I'm not here to think that we're either going to win this campaign or lose it, but I think it's very important that I make a statement with my life at a time when the climate change, there's a climate crisis right now. The government and the appropriate agencies are not responding. The power structure is so firmly entrenched that the kinds of drastic changes that all the scientists are telling us that we have to make are not going to be made in time. So, but I just did not want to sit around and see all this happen and realize that I hadn't done everything in my power to implement my convictions. And so that's why I'm down here in West Virginia. I frankly don't have a lot of hopes for this civilization unless there's some extreme turnover, unless we completely reverse our priorities and deal not only with problems like climate, but all the social problems and so on that we hope we're going to be effectively addressed by the current administration, but so far many of us have been, including me, have been very, very disappointed. That's one of the big frustrations, that so much is going on here that's just not, that the world may never know about. We have to wait for Howard Zinn in the next century, assuming we're still around, to write, to rewrite the history. So, you know, but we play the hand that we are dealt with, and hopefully we'll come through. So, I'm a Christian, and one of my motivations is that if anyone really asks me to summarize what I'm here for, is basically I'm exercising my obligations as a steward of the earth, and I'm here to protect creation.